Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion. You're listening to the Voice of Kansas on Blog Talk Radio. This is the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. And I'm your host, Carl G. This is the podcast mixtape for February 24th, 2024. As you may or may not be aware of, Kansas City won the Super Bowl a couple weeks ago. 1 million people attended a Super Bowl celebration at Union Station in Kansas City. At the end of the parade, there was a mass shooting. The Lords of Creation were quickly whisked away inside while several dozen received first aid for wounds, where one died on location. Now, the reason why I mention this is because our governor, he described the shooting as perpetrated by thugs and criminals. Even the Kansas City mayor had to say something about this. What we witnessed was a psychopathic killer. It's clear that mass shooters are psychopaths. They know the difference between right and wrong. They just don't care. 0.5% of the U.S. population are clinically psychopathic. If there were 1 million people gathered for this bread and circus, it's likely there could be 5,000 to 50,000 psychopaths gathered at one time. Psychopaths know the difference between right and wrong. We're going to do a Final Straw Radio rebroadcast from a couple weeks ago, where Burst interviews Andrew Lee, who's a journalist and a grassroots activist, on his new book, Defying Displacement, a book critical of neoliberal business and economic practice that became a template for squeezing the working class since 2008. This is from AK Press, released earlier in February 2024, where he first describes the San Francisco Chinatown being destroyed by gentrification, where a new San Francisco 49er stadium had been built. Then moves on to Philadelphia, where Anthony draws a stark contrast in displacing a large demographic of working class. You can find Andrew Lee at andrewleex.com, decolonizingphilly.ig, landliberationinphilly at firestorm.coop, and we encourage you all to check out the Channel Z Network, where you'll find more anarchist news and information. This is the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas, Blog Talk Radio, the Voice of Kansas, and I'm your host, Carl G.
Free, free,
Free, free, Palestine! I'm out here, locked down in the driveway of a Northrop Grumman munitions plant in Plymouth, Minnesota, right near Minneapolis. And I'm out here today because the weapons that are being manufactured at this facility are being sold to empires around the world, including Israel, for genocide and violence. And knowing that these weapons are being produced right here in our communities, in the heart of empire, we have a responsibility to stand up and take action. And today in Minneapolis, there's politicians debating whether or not to call for a ceasefire, and I'm tired of waiting for politicians to take action. We know that the state is not going to intervene to stop a settler colonial project happening in Palestine, and here I am today with some of the most beautiful people I've ever known, standing up can actually stop workers from coming into this plant to produce weapons, and I'm really grateful for the community and the chance to be here today.
We breathe together.
FM 103.3 LPFM in Asheville, this is The Final Straw Radio, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian broadcast and podcast emanating out of occupied Chalagi land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices and perspectives from projects and struggles all around the world, and you can find our archives, transcripts, ways to follow us and support us at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. This week we're sharing a recent chat with Andrew Lee, author of the book Defying Displacement, Urban Recomposition and Social War, released by AK Press on February 6th of 2024. Andrew and I talk about gentrification, speculation and financialization of housing, the destruction of communities by racial capitalism in the state, and some methods used to fight back and stay put. Andrew shouts out Decolonize Philly as a project to pay attention to. Hope you enjoy. So I'm joined by Andrew Lee, author of the book Defying Displacement, Urban Recomposition and Social War, which will be out from AK Press on February 6, 2024. Congrats on the book, and thank you for joining me for the chat. Would you mind telling us your correct gender pronouns, location, or other information that the audience might find helpful to know you?
Sure. My name's Andrew. I use he, him pronouns. I live and organize in Philly and used to live and organize in San Jose and the San Francisco Bay Area.
Can you talk a bit about what got you writing and thinking and fighting around issues of displacement?
This book really came out of my work in grassroots movements against displacement, which I've been involved with alongside other folks for several years now. And I think that there are these movements against gentrification that are really taking center stage in movement spaces in cities, not only across the country, but around the world. This is a huge social process, this transformation of urban areas and the expulsion of the remnants of the urban working class of color. And I started thinking about the issues that I raised in this book and try to dig deeper into the social process behind gentrification, because I think that there's something really novel happening in contemporary capitalism that these movements are grappling directly with. And I think there are a few reasons why it can be hard to see what's new in this process, because gentrification, it depends on, you know, exploitation and income inequality, which is very old, white supremacy and racism, which is also very old, and of course displacement itself isn't new. And the communities that are getting displaced with gentrification today have suffered double or triple displacements before, because these are communities of color. These are ethnic enclaves of folks who were displaced through slavery, through genocide, through imperialist wars, have landed in these urban communities, and now they're getting displaced once again. So none of these things are new, and it can look like it's just more of the same, which from one perspective, it is. But what is interesting about gentrification is that we're in a new period, especially in the United States, where pricing out working class people from cities is profitable for the richest people and institutions. And that is something that we haven't seen before. And it's leading to a wholesale transformation of the composition of cities based on a transformation in the way that value is captured in contemporary capitalism.
Everybody blood, them not take no chance. So when the violence gonna stop? Police and thief in a shootout. Now I did the other, them not cool out. In the community, the innocent to move out. The gangster, them need a new route. Police and thief couldn't be friends. Yet the two of them. Put the money on the dead and them theater. Them water, we don't read them. Them barn and shape out in a badness. Them treat life like a sadness. If them not go and jail, them get a casket. Them show no love at all. Who is to blame? Better them blame yourself. But you get your wings on, you can't explain yourself. Police. body blood, them not take no chat. So when the violence on us up, police and thief in a shootout. Now what is the other them not cool out? In the community the innocent a move out. The gangster them need a new route. Police and thief couldn't be friends. Yet the two of them are roots at the same trend.
I like how your book, while bringing in stories of people's experiences of having their communities ripped apart by capitalist processes, you also go into, I guess, a systematic approach to gentrification, because I've definitely lived in communities where I'm going to give up the same examples of like where gentrification is the like the white punk household or the artists moving in down the street, or where people point to the specific business that moves in that is the gentrification, you know, or rightly pointing to increased policing that occurs as white folks move in, or as like specialty businesses move into a neighborhood, but saying that it's not just those things, that those are kind of harbingers, I guess. Anyway, gentrification feels like a messy thing to talk about. And so I wonder if you could kind of break down what the process in your understanding of gentrification is, particularly in the current like tech reinvestment in cities and redisplacement of communities of color.
It does. So those two examples that are very common, like exemplars of gentrification in a lot of discourse, like the white punk house and the like hipster bakery, like those are part of the process of gentrification. But if that's where our analysis ends, we lose so much, and we lose really important opportunities to actually understand and combat this much broader social process. A lot of our discourse about gentrification is from the perspective of someone who may or may not be a gentrifier. Like, I moved to this neighborhood, am I a gentrifier? If I am a person of color, or if I'm queer, or if I grew up in a similar neighborhood. And that's sort of where our thinking about gentrification starts and stops in a lot of narratives and conversations. And what that does is it limits the anti-gentrification fight to like the feelings of a potential gentrifier. And then it's just about someone's, you know, guilt or lack of guilt. And what we're really talking about is ethical consumerism, right? It's about where is it ethical for me to consume a unit of housing? Just like, is it more ethical for me to consume, you know, this product from a co-op as opposed to Walmart? And like, of course, those things in both of those cases are significant, but we know that if our political analysis ends there, it's self-defeating because it remains within the confines of market decisions, and it doesn't allow us to tackle the broader structures within which people are making consumer choices. I think part of this is gentrification can be a really loosely defined word. And sometimes people use it to just mean an improvement in a neighborhood, like a capital improvement in a neighborhood. And from that, you have people writing think pieces about, oh, is gentrification good or bad? Can you have gentrification without displacement? And I think that's just muddying the waters, right? If you have an affluent community of well-off homeowners who improve their properties all at once, or get new streetlights, or have the sidewalk replaced, no one calls that gentrification. Gentrification isn't just like physical improvements to a neighborhood. It is displacement. Gentrification is inherently about displacement. And it's about displacement for profit. Like the communities that are getting gentrified, a generation or two ago, were largely working in manufacturing, assembly, here in Philly, textiles.
the body, body. Where that living it is harder. People running away from war, famine, disease and hunger. Some sail across the ocean and couple pieces of lumber.
So the people who, you couldn't own a factory or a sweatshop if you don't pay your workers enough to live next to it, right? It doesn't mean that these communities were paradises. It doesn't mean they weren't severely disinvested and repressed in a very intentional process starting from the federal government over the course of decades. But there was a financial incentive for the capitalist class to have those workers there so they can go to work. And those jobs and those industries no longer exist. The industries that exist in urban cores today, in the United States, but around the world, are tech, biotech, finance, real estate, the universities, the elite universities that train people to work in those fields, the tourist developments to entertain those same class of folks when they're on vacation. And these are industries, right, tech, finance, real estate, that don't require huge quantities of workers like assembly lines did. So you have a small section of workers and owners who are getting paid enough to gentrify, and people who would have composed the urban working class are now paid so little that their neighborhoods are gentrifiable.
There are significant portions of the book with focus on failed approaches to resolve displacement from a community standpoint, such as approaches to paragovernmental preservation, such as through UNESCO, voting in progressive politicians to city council, requirements on certain percentages of quote affordable housing units unquote per development, or reliance on the goodwill of NGOs or nonprofits to keep development or redevelopment within some limit, some sort of like reasonable rate that doesn't threaten the integrity of community. I wonder if you could talk about some of these approaches. I mean, if we're saying that like capital and the people that administer capital, obviously it's under the guise of a quote-unquote free market, but there are governmental agencies and nonprofits and such that help to define the goals of capital development and profitability that decide what a neighborhood should look like, and partially based, as you say, on what the what the needs of accumulation of capital through workers like are in an area. I wonder if you could talk about some of these approaches towards resolving the development of neighborhoods and the displacement of communities.
There are so many interventions from politicians, from NGOs, from gentrifying corporations and universities themselves that operate as if gentrification were an automatic natural process outside of human control that we're just trying to respond to. Like it's an earthquake. Like the earthquake happened, it's nobody's fault. There's going to be more earthquakes in the future. All we can do is pitch in and try to remedy the effects and prepare better for the next one. And that is not what gentrification is at all. And if you look at what these people are saying to one another, a very different picture emerges.
Push and a squeeze up, squeeze up.
So people who are involved in urban planning, municipal policies, those sort of fields, you have like a positive and a negative example for what you want your city to look like. Like the negative example is post-Great Recession Detroit, right? Capital flight, white flight, decreasing population. There's no money to do anything. We all, as you know, local political elites, would hate for that to be our city, right? The positive example is a place like Austin or Silicon Valley or San Francisco, where you have all of these very rich corporations. There's a lot of investment. People are flocking to them. And so a lot of urban planning is about how to engineer your city so it's, you know, more like San Jose than Detroit. And the thing that is important here is that San Jose is also a post-industrial city, just like a Detroit. San Jose used to have microchip factories before they were outsourced. So the area urbanized for microchip assembly line workers, all those jobs disappeared. The only reason why that area didn't have the same issues as post-Great Recession Detroit is because tech, R&D, and investment took over the area, which is to say the difference is gentrification. The difference is these corporations that are attracting highly paid workers and expelling everyone else. Gentrification is a positive policy outcome that is highly desirable to state and financial elites. Gentrification is something that is sought after and constructed by the state. And it's one of the chief things that local elites are looking to inspire, because that's the economic configuration in which we're in. The industries that can capture the most value are the ones that are paying this relatively small section of the working class enough to gentrify. So any of these interventions that are predicated on the idea that, you know, displacement just, it's just happening and we're all doing our best to take care of it, they're lies. They're built on lies. And maybe not all of these people have the intellectual honesty to admit to themselves what they're doing, but they are aiming to create gentrification. They are actively creating gentrification through tax abatements, through zoning, through all sorts of mechanisms, but local municipal elites are desperately looking for gentrification. The corporations that want to create hubs of their educated workers, which is what the San Francisco Bay Area provides for tech firms, right? People go there and you can work at different tech firms. You can work at a startup. You can work at a big five like Google. You can bounce around. There's an educated workforce with the required skills. There's coding boot camps to feed people into that. There's, you know, the venture capital firms. You can go talk to someone in person. And you have the conversion of more and more of these cities into areas that are designed to be appealing for this type of worker. So that's where you get, you know, the coffee shop, the yoga studio, all of that. That's a good job perk, right? If I move to the city to work for this company, I get to, you know, go out to this commercial district with my millionaire friends. So for the companies that are creating gentrification, it's also a positive outcome that their financial growth depends on. If gentrification didn't happen, they would have to pay their workers more to absorb those housing costs. So it could. I also think a lot of fights around displacement, because it is so produced by the state, a lot of local movements, you know, have to engage with municipal politics, or at least affected by municipal politics on some level. And I understand that there have been, you know, local politicians who take better or worse stances in regards to public pressure from the outside. And, you know, I'm not one to, you know, rate off a movement because they decide to, you know, ask a politician to not ethnic cleanse them quite so fast, right? That's not really, I think, my place. But I do think that there are limitations if we're looking at electoral politics at the local level as the thing that will stop displacement, that will end gentrification. I think that there needs to be an extra political, extra legal force for two reasons. First, like I said, this is the way to run a functional city government under what has been called the Fourth Industrial Revolution, the knowledge economy, the new economy, what I argue could just as easily be called the gentrification economy. Cities that don't gentrify don't have money. Cities that do gentrify do. If you are a politician of any stripe, the rational thing for you to do over the long term is to support gentrification.
Protection we need, Lord. They brought you in this society to protect us. Now you start to treat us like a dog. Don't even respect that I am your brother. And a civilian like brute. Policeman, where is the respect gone? Oh, Lord. Policeman, where is the respect gone? Yeah. Policeman, where is the respect gone? I don't hear you when you say, policeman, where is the respect gone? You look at my grandfather. They call him a boy. Think of a puppy at my grandfather's age. Do you believe that he's a small dog? Oh, policeman, where is the respect gone? Oh yeah, policeman, where is the respect gone? You lost it, policeman.
Got to
So if we're going to try to push outside that, which I think we must, I mean, I think that there's real limitations about, you know, depending on like a council member to try to stem that tide. The other thing about gentrification is the people who are most negatively affected by gentrification are, of course, the people who get displaced. And if we're talking about local municipal government, that means that they aren't that politician's constituents anymore. The people who benefit the most from gentrification are new arrivals. Those are the people who become that politician's constituent. And we also know that you know, participation in voting correlates with wealth and education level. So the people who are moving in are already more inclined to waste their time voting than the people who are getting pushed out. So I think just because of the structure of like what local government is and the fact that gentrification involves getting removed from a local area, they're getting new constituents. That's what this process is. They're getting new constituents who are the beneficiaries of displacement. The people who were attacked by these political decisions, there's no longer any mechanism for accountability.
I'd like to talk a little bit about what displacement looks like. There's the examples of, like, obviously that somebody experienced in their household or in their neighborhood of increasing cost of living, decreasing availability of employment, increasing policing, these sorts of things. But I think that there's, like, it's kind of interesting to look at shifts, at least in how I understand, in the way that the populations have been moved around by racial capitalism. So looking at, say, back in the post-World War II era, folks had moved in a lot of cases to where jobs were or where relatives, friends, or other community were, around job centers, around factories. As deindustrialization occurs, white flight occurs, right? A lot of white middle and upper class folks move out of the cities into the suburbs, which brings a lot of the tax base with it. Industries simultaneously are moving factories to less urban, less unionized areas, and then eventually out of the country in a lot of cases. And there's some like global dynamics to this. It's not just about those specific factory owners. And then we see this process now that communities that had been existing, like a lot of them racialized communities that have been living for generations in metropolitan cores, being forced out over the last few decades through redevelopment, including nonprofits and capital working with government to use eminent domain to break down pre-existing communities, black and brown communities to a large degree, so as to remake pockets to reinvite capital and some of those white communities that have moved out to the suburbs back in, pushing a lot of people out to the cores. So you have like a disinvestment in suburbs that now have like large communities of people of color as capital moves back into the inner cities. Is that like a fair breakdown of like how that dynamic kind of looks from a wider scale, or am I missing some pieces?
Yes, I think that's right. And I really want to hone in on the role of race here. When we look at investment in a neighborhood, reinvestment, incentivized gentrification. What makes, if I'm an investor, right, I want to invest in a property that's going to grow in value the most, obviously. It's what geographer Neil Smith calls the rent cap, right? The current value of a property, the gap between that and what its future value could be. So neighborhoods with particularly low current values represent the largest potential growth. That's why, you know, middle class neighborhoods aren't gentrified.
Remember our day of slavery, our people sold out to Babylon. Trick us out of our land, but not the trade.
he was a blessed man, yeah. Remember for Marcus, Yahweh, he was a predictor. Brother Paul Bodo, he fights so hard to save his life, yeah.
One of the largest determinants of land value in the United States is race. An equivalent house and an equivalent neighborhood, same conditions, same upkeep, same number of bedrooms. If one of those identical houses is in a white neighborhood and the other house is in an equivalent in every other way black neighborhood, the white house is valued at $48,000 more than the house in the black neighborhood. So let's think about displacement. If I'm investing in a black neighborhood, the only thing that would have to happen for me to see a $48,000 profit on my investment would be not new businesses coming in, although that's obviously an incentive, right? Not the streets getting fixed, you know, not any sort of, not a new bus line, nothing other than the changing racial composition of the neighborhood. If I can just get the tenants and all of their neighbors to be people of a different race, I make $48,000. So gentrification in the United States is deeply tied in to race and white supremacy, and it's tied in ways that go beyond the personal prejudices of like an individual gentrifier because of the deep racism in U.S. society expressed in the housing market. There's a quote-unquote rational incentive for race-based displacement, even if you as an investor, you know, you personally, right, maybe you aren't bigoted, if the only thing you cared about would be making as much money as possible and you had absolutely no thoughts about racial discrimination or anything, the thing you would do rationally just for your own pocketbook would be to invest in racial displacement. So I think that's a huge component of displacement, and it's one of the things that makes displacement so painful and damaging is these are communities where despite repression, despite disinvestment, you know, different communities, black, brown, and immigrant communities have carved out a little space where they can have community, where they can have history, where they can have, you know, mutual recognition. And when those places get destroyed, there's no plan B. Like, I'm part of the campaign in solidarity with the folks who live in Philadelphia's Chinatown to stop them from getting displaced by a proposed basketball arena. And what I tell people is, like, there's no plan B for Chinatown. And Chinatowns across the country have gotten obliterated by redevelopment in the last few decades. There's no like second tier slightly worse backup Chinatown that people are going to move to. If it's gone, at least for the foreseeable future, it's gone. And those communities get dispersed. You know, and maybe there's like pockets of folks in different places, certainly less dense, certainly less connected, certainly less history, but the community itself is destroyed. So the streets are going to stay there. Maybe some of the buildings are going to stay there, but the actual flesh and blood people who make an area a neighborhood, that neighborhood, for all intents and purposes, ceases to exist. That's, I think, one of the most challenging things about gentrification. I'm thinking through it as like the communities that we are in are what give us our social identity, right? No matter what kind of community, subculture, cultural group, like, we all want that, right? A place where we can be recognized for who we are, where we can recognize other people, where we can, you know, express our full, you know, social identities to people who will accept them with respect, right? Everyone wants that. Those spaces are what is getting destroyed by the process of gentrification, by the intersection of racial capitalism, the financialization of the housing market, and this, you know, new economy of large firms and universities trying to colonize inner city areas for capital accumulation.
Our ancestors, they treat them so bad. They let them work the plantation, even plow the earth. They work them and work them. They work them to death. Now they wanna come play the same trick on us. They ain't gonna play the same trick on us. Back way, you a vampire. Back way, slave master. Back way, you a vampire. I look into my history. I will feed my heart, make my blood run cold, and I feel I cry. Our ancestors, they treat them so bad. They let them work the plantation, even plow the earth. And they work them and work them. They work them to death now.
And still, we have people saying that gentrification could be good. There are people writing reports saying that gentrification does not exist. That it's like that, you know, there's maybe like, you know, two places in the country where it's happening, but it's like it's very rare. It's inconsequential. These are untrue. These are untrue. And the problem is, you know, there's so little research being done, you know, tracking the number of people who get displaced from these communities, that you have people talking about supposedly objective information, like, oh, the tax base is growing, the streets have more whites, the average income has gone up, all these supposedly objective universal facts against what gets framed as the sort of misguided selfish interests of a specific community in not getting wiped off the face of the earth.
Yeah, and the example of, like, the income levels are higher, the, like, buying potential, the tax base, whatever, these are the people that you're describing, or you described before, as the replacement people. These are the new constituents. These are not, it's not about bringing up the people that were already living in the community. And it's good to remind folks that, like, that property ownership is one of the fundamental ways for intergenerational transfer of wealth, for accumulation of wealth, and for it to be passed down through people's families and thus through people's communities. And so when there are systematic approaches towards divesting people, whether it be through the sort of shenanigans that brought about the economic collapse in 2008 by focusing subprime mortgages towards black and brown consumers, or the deployment of eminent domain by cities and redevelopment agencies, like, this is a fundamental outcome of it, is the continued disinvestment of already systematized, like, racialized and indigent communities or working class communities, right?
Yes.
What sorts of models of resistance to displacement have you seen successful in your work and study on the subject? And what could success mean in this instance where the market economy continues to exist with the government backing it?
Yeah, so there are so many communities around the world that are trying to grapple with this very question right now of what successful resistance to displacement looks like, of what victory really looks like for our communities. I think we're in a place that might be, you know, analogous to that the workers' movement was in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, right, where there were a lot of folks, there was a lot of spontaneous factory occupations, walkouts, union activity, and people were filling out how to build out, you know, structures and theories around that, because they saw that these struggles brought them directly into conflict with the most powerful forces in their global economy. With so many workers today work in a very fragmented labor market. People work at small businesses, you work at mom and pops, you work as an independent contractor, you work in the informal economy. It's no longer, you know, me and a couple thousand of my closest friends at the, you know, the Manchester factories. So when a lot of these struggles kick off, you aren't actually fighting the capitalist class, and a lot of times you just go out of business. The people who are being put into confrontation with the, to use a term of art, commanding heights of the contemporary economy, are movement against displacement. I think that we can defeat these developments today. I think
you're listening to the Voice of Kansas on Blog Talk Radio. This is the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas, and I'm your host, Carl G. Nancy Fraser is an American philosopher, critical theorist, feminist, and a Henry A. and Louise Loeb Professor of Political and Social Science, Professor of Philosophy at the New School in New York City. Fraser has written on a wide variety of issues, but she is primarily known for her work on philosophical conceptions of justice and injustice. Fraser argues that justice can be understood in two separate but interrelated ways: distributive justice, in terms of more equitable distribution of resources, and recognition justice, the recognition of difference between social identities and groups. There are two corresponding forms of injustice, maldistribution, and misrecognition. Frazier argues that many social justice movements in the 1960s and the 1970s argued for recognition on the basis of race, gender, sexuality, or ethnicity, and that the focus on correcting misrecognition eclipsed the importance of challenging the persistent problems of maldistribution. In other words, Frazier asserts that too many focus on identity politics diverts attention from the delirious effects of neoliberal capitalism and the growing wealth inequality that characterizes many societies. In more recent work, Frazier goes even further in linking the narrow focus of identity politics with the widening gap between the rich and poor, particularly with regard to liberal feminism, which Frazier calls the handmaiden of capitalism. Reflecting on Sheryl Sandberg's 2013 book, Lean In, Frazier explained, "For me, feminism is not simply a matter of getting a smattering of individual women into positions of power and privilege within existing social hierarchies. It's rather about overcoming those hierarchies. This requires challenging the structural sources of gender domination in the capitalist society. Above all, the institutionalized separation of two supposedly distinct kinds of activity. On one hand, so-called productive labor historically associated with men remunerated by wages. On the other hand, caring activities often historically unpaid and still performed mainly by women. In my view, this gendered hierarchical division between production and reproduction is a defining structure of capitalist society and a deep source of the gender asymmetries hardwired in it. There can be no emancipation of women so long as this structure remains intact." This is the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas, Blog Talk Radio, the voice of Kansas, and I'm your host, Carl G.
What should socialism mean in the 21st century? A small question. Fortunately, it resonates and to some degree overlaps with things that Etienne has said and things that Achille has said. But I want to start from a specifically U.S. phenomenon, and that's the surprising way in which socialism is back. For decades, this word was considered an embarrassment, a despised failure, a relic of a bygone era. No more. Today, politicians like Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez wear this label proudly, and they win support. Organizations like Democratic Socialists of America, DSA, attract new members in drove under that precise banner. But what exactly do they mean by socialism? However welcome, enthusiasm for the word does not translate automatically into serious reflection on its content. What exactly does or should socialism signify in the present era? Well, in this lecture, I'm going to provide some extremely sketchy and preliminary thoughts that do not add up to an answer, but may begin to sketch a path toward an answer. Drawing on an expanded conception of capitalism, I shall suggest that we need an expanded conception of socialism, one that overcomes the narrow economism of received understandings. Disclosing the capitalist economy's contradictory and destructive relations to its quote-unquote non-economic presuppositions, I shall contend that socialism must do more than only transform the realm of production. Over and above that desideratum, which I wholeheartedly endorse, socialism must also transform production's relations to its background conditions of possibility, namely to social reproduction, state power, non-human nature, and a variety of forms of wealth that lie outside capital's official circuits but are within its reach. In other words, as I'll explain, a socialism for our time must overcome not only capital's exploitation of wage labor, but also its free riding on unwaged care work, on public goods, and on wealth expropriated from racialized subjects and from non-human nature. The result, as I said, if we could get such a conception, would be an expanded conception of socialism. But expansion here does not mean mere addition. The point is not to add more features to received understandings while leaving the latter unchanged. It's rather to revise our views of both capitalism and socialism by incorporating into them structural accounts of matters that are usually considered secondary: gender, sexuality, race, ethnicity, nationality, empire, ecology, and democracy. The result should, if it's successful, be to cast a new light on all the classical topoi of socialist thought, on the concepts of domination and emancipation, on class and crisis, on property, markets, and planning, on necessary labor, free time, and social surplus. Now, obviously, I won't be able to give anything close to even a sketchy account of all of those matters in this lecture. But I will have something to say, however preliminary, about three of these topoi, namely institutional boundaries, social surplus, and the role of markets. In each case, I'm going to try to show that and how the topic in question assumes a different guise once we view capitalism as something more than an economy, and once we view socialism as something more than an alternative economic system. The view of socialism that I hope will emerge from this exercise would differ sharply from Soviet-style communism on the one hand and from social democracy on the other. However, I have to begin with capitalism. In my view, this is the necessary starting point for any discussion of socialism. Socialism, after all, is no mere ought or utopian dream. If it's worth discussing now, it is rather because it encapsulates real historically emergent possibilities, real societal potentials for human freedom, well-being, and happiness that capitalism has brought into being as potentials but cannot realize. Equally important, socialism is a response to capitalism's impasses and injustices, both to the problem the system generates non-accidentally and that it cannot solve, and to the structural domination and social divisions that are built into capitalist society. In other words, socialism claims to remedy capitalism's ills. And so it is there that we must begin, only by identifying capitalism's constitutive dynamics and institutional structures can we grasp exactly what it is that must be transformed. And only by proceeding on that basis can we envision the positive outlines of a socialist alternative. So my first question here is, what exactly is capitalism and what is wrong with it? All right, well, that's two questions. Okay. First, often capitalism is understood as an economic system whose defining components are private property and market exchange, wage labor and commodity production, credit and finance, profit, interest and rent. All elements denominated in money and combined in such a way as to institutionalize economic growth as a system imperative. On this view, capitalism coincides with the range of activities, relations, and objects that are monetized, held to embody or produce economic value. I'm going to call this the narrow or restricted view of capitalism, held by most businessmen and businesswomen and most mainstream economists. It is also, I would say, the unreflective common sense of society at large. So much so that even many of capitalism's critics on the left tend unwittingly to subscribe to versions of this narrow view of it. That's the case of what I will call, following Moish Postone, traditional Marxism. It views capitalism as a system of class exploitation centered on the relation between capitalists and workers at the point of production. The key relation is thought to be between those who own the means of production as their private property on the one hand, and those who own nothing but their capacity to work and must therefore sell that peculiar commodity to a capitalist in order to live on the other hand. This relation is crystallized in a market transaction in which labor power is exchanged for wages, but it is not an exchange of equivalents. I'm outlining now this traditional Marxist view. On the contrary, the capitalist pays only for the workers' socially necessary labor time, meaning the hours needed to produce a sum of value that equals the cost of the workers' subsistence or reproduction. Capitalist appropriates the rest of the workers' labor time as surplus value. So that's the meaning of the idea that this is a relationship of exploitation. Exploitation, on the narrow view of capitalism, is the very crux of the system. It is the secret of surplus value, the driver of technological innovation and of rising productivity, but also the source of poverty and class inequality, the motor of wholesale irrationality, of non-accidental bouts of mass unemployment and periodic outbreaks of economic crisis. Now, clearly, the traditional Marxian view of capitalism is a big improvement over the standard, let's say, mainstream bourgeois view, and yet it, too, remains overly narrow. This view focuses single-mindedly on what Marx called the hidden abode of production, while failing to interrogate the latter's conditions of possibility, production's conditions of possibility. These must be sought elsewhere, I claim, in other non-economic abodes that are more hidden still.
Marcus Giave family, ancestors no leave me. Naya Bingi, Bobo Shanti. Ay, 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 ay. Oh, oh, oh. Hey, hey, listen, the blood of African kings run in my veins. Here in Jamaica, rebellious offspring. We've got a warrior spirit inside from that time which I changed. And this a warrior spirit inside, it comes to break every shackle and chain. Mana Shaka Zulu, Whitney, Nkrumah, Whitney, Kunta Kinte, Whitney, the
just like Malcolm and Martin and Marcus and Fiery Kumar.
Bene,
Fela Kuti.
Bene,
Kunta Kinte.
Bene,
just like Javi and Marley and Fiery. Look how many years them whip with. That's where they whip our microchip with. And I don't see Babylon style up with me. Buckle it out, come make we get to with victory. Them fight my brother and sister. And when we are dance, them say we're moving sinister. When all we do is love and we culture. I beat the drums and we are chase the vultures away. Mana Shaka Zulu,
Bene,
Paul Bogle,
Bene,
Lulumba,
Bene.
It's like Martin and Malcolm and Marcus and Fiery Kiavi,
Bene,
King Selassie,
Bene,
Mandela,
Bene.
It's like Marcus and Martin and Fiery. The thoughts of freedom fight and dwell in my brain. Stolen from Africa, the mission is still the same. We've got a warrior spirit inside. It's well while can't him. And this a warrior spirit inside. It comes to break every shackle and chain. And they might try brainwash me. Times we mind the meditation dirty. They never tell we say black is beauty. Me nah go bleach, me say me nah dilute it. No, hey, you search your history. Break the puzzle, come make we solve the mystery. Hey, a Solomonic dynasty from the line of David, what a priceless legacy. Mana Shaka Zulu,
Bene,
Nkrumah,
Bene,
Kunta Kinte,
Bene.
Just like Malcolm and Martin and Javi and Fiery Nani,
Bene,
Samson,
Bene,
Bujuneke,
Bene.
Just like Martin and Marley and Javi and Fiery.
While traditional Marxism captures the front story of capitalist society, so to speak, it glosses over the back story, which makes it not so much wrong as incomplete. To complete the picture, and thereby to arrive at a full understanding of capitalist society, we need to go beyond not only the mainstream economic conception, but also the traditional Marxian alternative. Plumbing the more hidden depth beneath production, we need to disclose the non-economic conditions that make it possible. I'm going to mention briefly four such non-economic conditions for the possibility of a capitalist society, and you will see soon why it's important that socialism be constructed as an alternative to this whole enlarged order. Now, the first condition is a sizable fund of unwaged labor devoted to what feminists call social reproduction. This labor includes housework, the birthing and rearing of children, the care of adults, including wage workers, the elderly, and the unemployed. In effect, these are forms of people-making, which constitute an indispensable precondition for profit-making. Without them, there could be no workers, no labor power, no necessary or surplus labor time, no exploitation, no surplus value, no accumulation of capital, no profit. And yet, essential as they are, capital accords them no value, is totally unconcerned to replenish them, and seeks to avoid paying for them insofar as it can. There's also a second non-economic precondition for a capitalist economy, and that's a large fund of wealth expropriated from subjugated peoples, especially from racialized peoples. This wealth includes dependent, unfree, and unwaged or underwaged labor, but also expropriated land, looted mineral and energy deposits, human bodies and bodily organs, even children and reproductive capacities, all serving in one way or another throughout capitalism's history as inputs to capitalist production for which capital pays little or nothing. Expropriated wealth was an indispensable source of capital stockpiling at the start of the system's history, as Marx maintained in his discussion of primitive accumulation. But it did not cease with the system's maturation. On the contrary, the capitalist economy relies even now on a continuing stream of free or cheap inputs as a major source feeding into accumulation alongside and interimbricated with exploitation. Absent such expropriation of subject peoples, the exploitation of free workers would not be profitable. Yet capital disavows its reliance on such wealth and refuses again to pay for its replenishment. A third non-economic precondition for a capitalist economy is a large fund of free gifts, that's a phrase Marx used, and or cheap, Jason Moore's phrase, inputs from non-human nature. These supply the indispensable material substratum of capitalist production, the raw materials that labor transforms, the energy that powers machines and the foodstuffs that power bodies, hence arable land, breathable air, potable water, and of course, as we are now increasingly aware, the carbon-carrying capacities of the Earth's atmosphere. Absent these natural ecological conditions, there could be no economic producers or social reproducers, no wealth to expropriate or no free labor to exploit, no capital, no capitalists.
Look lifeless like me. We miss you on your side of the bed. Still got your things here. They stare at me like souvenirs. Don't wanna let you out my head. Like the day that I met you, the day I thought forever. Never cold outside. Like when you walked on my life, why you walk on my life? I feel like this every time. On these days it feel like you and me. Heartbreak anniversary. I remember every time. Like presents and open to this day. I still got the messages you read. I'm foolishly patient. Can't get back the taste of your kiss. Don't wanna let you out my head. Like the day that I met you, thought this was forever. To love me, I would think forever. It's cold outside. Like when you walk on my life, why you walk on my life? Do you ever think?
Yet again, capital treats nature as a source of free or very cheap gifts to which it helps itself but fails to replenish or repair. A fourth and final non-economic precondition for a capitalist economy is a large fund of public goods supplied by states and other public powers. These include legal orders that guarantee property rights, contracts, and free exchange, also repressive forces that ensure order, put down rebellions, manage dissent, and enable expropriation both within and beyond state territory. Also, a money supply that stores value and enables transactions across broad swaths of time and space, transport and communications infrastructure, and a whole variety of mechanisms for managing system crises. Absent these public goods, there could be no social order, no trust, hence no exchange, no sustained accumulation. And yet, capital tends to resent public power and seeks to evade the taxes that are necessary to sustain it and, in general, to weaken it in the immediate interest of its accumulation. Now, each of these four conditions represents, as I've said, an indispensable presupposition of a capitalist economy. Each harbors social relations, social activities, and forms of social wealth that together form the sine qua non of accumulation. Behind capitalism's official institutions, wage, labor, production, exchange, finance, stand their necessary supports and enabling conditions: families, communities, nature, territorial states, political organizations, civil society, and not least of all, massive amounts and multiple forms of unwaged and expropriated labor. Fundamentally integral to capitalist society, these two are all constitutive elements of it. Capitalism, in other words, is no mere economy. It's something much larger. It's an institutionalized social order in which an arena of economized activities and relations is marked out and set apart from other non-economized zones on which the former depend, but which they disavow. A capitalist society, then, comprises an economy that is distinct from and dependent on a polity or political order, an arena of economic production that is distinct from and dependent on a zone of social reproduction, a set of relations of exploitation that is distinct from and dependent on background relations of expropriation, and a socio-historical realm of human activity that is held to be distinct from and dependent on what is envisioned as an ahistorical material substratum of non-human nature. So what I'm suggesting then is that we now leave behind the narrow view of capitalism as an economy. Conceiving it rather as an institutionalized social order, we arrive at an expanded view. This expanded view of capitalist society has major consequences, I believe, for the project of reimagining socialism. It changes, indeed enlarges, our sense of what exactly is wrong with capitalism and what must be done to transform it. So now, let me take up that second question, what's wrong with capitalism? On the narrow view, there are three main wrongs built into capitalism, I would say, namely injustice, irrationality, and unfreedom. I want to say, I don't disagree with that, but I want to say a word about how each is interpreted within the narrow view. On the narrow view, as I already suggested, capitalism's core injustice consists in the exploitation by capital of the class of free propertyless workers, wage workers. The latter, as I said, work many hours for free, producing enormous wealth in which they have very little share. The benefits flow rather to the capitalist class, which appropriates their surplus labor and the surplus value generated by it, reinvesting the latter for that class's own purposes of further and ever-expanding accumulation. The larger consequence is the relentless, indeed exponential, growth of capital as a hostile power that dominates the very workers who produce it. That is the core injustice on the narrow view, and it's already a pretty big one, let's face it, namely the class exploitation of wage labor at the point of production. This is a wrong whose locus is the capitalist economy, specifically the sphere of commodity or economic production. Now, on the narrow view, capitalism's chief irrationality is its built-in tendency to economic crisis. An economic system oriented to the limitless accumulation of surplus value, appropriated privately in the form of profit, is inherently self-destabilizing. The drive to increase profit by increasing productivity through technical advances results in periodic falls in the rate of profit, which may or may not be compensated for by counter tendencies in the overproduction of goods and in the overaccumulation of capital. Attempted fixes like financialization only postpone the day of reckoning while ensuring it will be all the more severe when it does finally arrive. In general, then, the course of capitalist development on this view is punctuated by periodic economic crises, by boom-bust cycles, stock market crashes, financial panics, bankruptcy chains, mass liquidations of value, and mass unemployment. This is all the narrow view, and believe me, there's a lot that's impressive about it. I don't mean to suggest otherwise. Finally, the narrow view entails that capitalism is deeply and constitutively undemocratic. Granted, it often promises democracy in the political realm, but that promise is systematically undercut by social inequality on the one hand and class power on the other. Then, too, the capitalist workplace is thoroughly exempt from any pretense of democratic self-governance. That's a sphere where capital commands and workers obey. On the narrow view, then, capitalism non-accidentally entrenches three chief wrongs. First, it lives by exploiting and dominating wage laborers. I'm summarizing here. Second, it's structurally primed to spawn periodic economic crises. And finally, it's constitutively non-democratic.
Revelation time.
Now, the trouble arises in each one of these cases from the inherent dynamics of capitalism's economy. Built into the DNA of that system, the wrongs of capitalism reside on the narrow view in its economic organization. Once again, I want to say that that picture is not so much wrong as incomplete. While correctly disclosing something about capitalism's inherent economic ills, it fails to register a range of non-economic injustices and crisis tendencies that are equally constitutive of and grounded in this mode of social organization. These come clearly into view when we adopt the expanded conception of capitalist society. So now I want to go through those three wrongs and show you how they look from the expanded perspective. First, the expanded view of capitalism discloses an expanded catalog of systemic injustices. Far from residing within its economy, these tend to be grounded rather in the divisions between the capitalist economy and its non-economic conditions of possibility. The division between economic production, where labor is remunerated in cash wages, and social reproduction, where it is often, although not always, unwaged, sentimentalized, recompensed in love, that's a case in point. Historically gendered, this division entrenches a fundamental gender asymmetry at the heart of capitalist society. It grounds the subordination of women, gender binarism, and is closely connected, though not identical, with heteronormativity. Similarly, capitalist societies institute a structural division between free workers who can exchange their labor power for the cost of their reproduction and dependent others whose persons and assets can simply be seized. Unable to access rights protections or the full cost of their own reproduction in the form of a wage, the latter group provides capital with a stream of free or cheap inputs that swell the tide of profit. The status division between the merely exploitable and the downright expropriable is fundamental to capitalist society, and it coincides roughly but unmistakably, in my view, with the global color line. It undergirds a range of structural injustices, including racial oppression, imperialisms both old and new, indigenous dispossession, and genocide. Then, too, capitalist societies institute a sharp division between human beings and non-human nature, which cease to belong to the same ontological universe. Reduced to a tap on the one hand and a sink on the other, non-human nature is open to brute extractivism and instrumentalization. Now, if we don't want to say, and I'm open to either possibility, that this is an injustice against nature or perhaps against non-human animals, it is at the very least an injustice against existing and future generations of human beings who are left with an increasingly uninhabitable planet. Finally, capitalism institutes a structural division between the economic and the political. On one side stands the private power of capital to organize production using only the lash of hunger and need. On the other side stands the public power of the state, which is supposed to monopolize legitimate violence and represent or incarnate law. The effect of this division is to truncate the scope of the political, expelling from the public agenda a range of life and death questions, as I will shortly explain. Devolving those matters to capital, capitalist societies offer only a poor and shrunken facsimile of democracy, subjecting supposedly self-governing citizens to capital's arbitrary rule. These societies are veritable cauldrons of political injustice. So in general, an expanded view of capitalist society makes visible an expanded catalog of structural injustices, every bit as deep-seated and non-accidental as class exploitation. These injustices really are structural. A socialist alternative to capitalist society must remedy them too. Far from merely transforming the organization of economic production, it must also transform the latter's relation to social reproduction, and with it, to the gender and the sexual orders. It must end capital's free riding on nature's free or cheap gifts and expropriation of the wealth of racialized populations. It must expand the scope of democratic self-rule beyond their current miserable limits. In sum, if socialism is to remedy capitalism's injustices, it must change not just the economy, but the entire institutionalized social order that is capitalist society. But if that sounds like a big job, it's not all. The expanded view of capitalism also enlarges our sense of what counts as a capitalist crisis. This is down to the irrationality problem. This view discloses some built-in self-destabilizing propensities above and beyond those internal to its economy. It discloses first a structural tendency to social reproductive crisis. Insofar as capital tries to avoid paying for the unwaged care work on which it depends, and therefore periodically puts enormous pressure on the chief providers of that work, namely families, communities, and above all, women. The current financialized form of capitalist society is especially guilty on this point. It is generating just such a crisis today, as it demands simultaneously both retrenchment of public provision of social services and vastly increased hours of wage work per household and from women. That's a huge pincers movement on social reproduction. The expanded view also discloses an inherent tendency within capitalism to ecological crisis, insofar as capital works overtime to avoid paying anything close to the true replacement costs of the inputs it takes from non-human nature. Depleting the soil and befouling the seas, this system floods carbon sinks and overwhelms the carbon-carrying capacity of the planet, helping itself to all of those things while disavowing their repair and replacement costs. It periodically destabilizes the metabolic interaction between the human and non-human components of nature. I don't need to belabor here how acute is our present ecological crisis. Capitalism's tendency to ecological and social reproductive crises are inseparable from its constitutive reliance on expropriated wealth from racialized populations, its reliance, as I said, on stolen lands, coerced labor, and looted minerals, on racialized zones as dumping grounds for toxic waste, and as suppliers of underpaid care work now increasingly organized in global care chains. The result is an intertwining of economic, ecological, and social crisis with racial ethnic antagonism. Neoliberalism has clearly upped the ante here as well. Finally, the enlarged view of capitalism discloses a deep-seated tendency to political crisis. Here, too, capital tries to have it both ways, living off of public goods for which it tries not to pay, avoiding taxes to the degree it can, and scheming constantly to weaken state regulatory capacities. It tends to hollow out the very public powers on which it depends. The current financialized form of capitalism takes this game to a whole new level. Mega corporations outgun territorially tethered public powers, while global finance takes it upon itself to discipline states, making a mockery of elections as in Greece and preventing elected governments from addressing popular claims, even if some of them might have wanted to. Not all of them even want to, of course. The result is a major crisis of governance. The EU could be like the poster child for this, which is now reflected in an actual crisis of hegemony. That's political crisis at a different level, as masses of people across the globe defect from established political parties and established political common sense. So in general, the expanded view discloses that capitalism harbors multiple crisis tendencies above and beyond the economic. I understand these other crisis tendencies as premised on what I would call inter-realm contradictions. I'm really thinking kind of Polanyi here more than Marx. Contradictions that are lodged at the joints that separate and simultaneously connect the capitalist economy to its non-economic background conditions of possibility.
Won't somebody tell me please what's going on?
In a nutshell, capital has a built-in tendency to erode or destroy or deplete, but in any case to destabilize its own conditions of possibility, which is to say, to eat its own tail. This, too, is part and parcel of what is wrong with capitalist society and of what socialism must overcome. Finally, the expanded view of capitalist society discloses an enlarged view of its democratic deficits. The problem is not only that economic inequality and class power thwart the possibility of equal democratic voice in the political realm, nor is it only that bosses command on the factory floor. Equally, if not more important, is the preemptive removal of the most consequential matters from the scope of decision of democratic decision-making altogether. How should we organize the production of goods of use values that satisfy our needs? On what energetic basis and through what sorts of social relations? How should we relate the production of goods to the reproductions of persons on the one hand and to that of non-human nature on the other? And perhaps most important of all, how shall we dispose over the social surplus we collectively produce? In capitalist societies, we have virtually no say in these matters. Investors bent on maximal accumulation decide them behind our backs. In general, then, an expanded view of capitalist society discloses an expanded view of the system's ills. If socialism aims to remedy capitalism's wrongs, it faces a very big job. It must invent a new social order that overcomes not only, again in quotes, class domination, but also asymmetries of gender and sex, racial ethnic imperial oppressions, and political domination across the board. Then, too, it must deinstitutionalize multiple crisis tendencies, not just economic and financial, but also ecological, social, reproductive, and political. Finally, a socialism for the 21st century must vastly enlarge the purview of democracy to encompass not just decision-making within a predefined political zone, but more fundamentally, it must democratize the very process of definition and demarcation, the very frames that constitute the political. Now that brings me to the hard part. What then is socialism on this expanded view? Clearly, the project of rethinking socialism for the 21st century is itself a pretty big job, far too big for any single person or for even a single group of persons engaged in theorizing. If the job gets done at all, which I admit is a pretty big if, it will be through the combined efforts of activists and theorists as insights gained through social struggle synergize with programmatic thinking and with political organization. Nevertheless, I want to offer three sets of very brief reflections that seem to me to follow somehow from what I have already said. And these have to do with institutional boundaries, the question of the joints, with social surplus, and with the role of markets. Now I have to point very soon, switch to my handwritten text that I didn't have time to type into the computer. I hope I can.